At about 7 a.m. on a December morning in 1996, Dr. Jill Taylor, a research scientist in neuroanatomy and a lecturer at Harvard Medical School, experienced a stroke in the left hemisphere of her brain. Over the next 4 hours, she observed her mind deteriorate in its ability to process information and to connect with the rest of her body. Over the next 8 years of treatment and rehabilitation, Dr. Taylor discovered that the stroke itself and its complex neurological manifestations was not central to what her life was really about. The stroke was indeed a traumatic event, yet it was also a turning point through which profound insights came to her about stuff that really matters. And in the same sense, today's service is not really about strokes or about any other tipping point event. To be sure, some such events may be traumatic and even catastrophic. And yet it is through such tipping points that the doors of perception often open wide, and new landscapes, perspectives, opportunities, and personal priorities may emerge. In fact, you and I are here today on North 10th Street, on planet Earth, bipeds and tennis shoes, by virtue of a catastrophe, one that you may know about, the Chicxulub event, when an extraterrestrial impact 65 million years ago wiped out the dinosaurs and allowed us mammals to emerge, to develop, to thrive, to create daytime television and other wonders. So to set the stage for today's conversations, I've selected a short reading from Dr. Taylor's remarkable book, My Stroke of Insight, A Brain Scientist's Personal Journey. The reading is from a chapter entitled, What I Needed the Most. This is by Dr. Jill Taylor. Recovery was a decision that I had to make a million times a day. Because it was a conscious decision, it was important that I be surrounded by competent and attentive caregivers. Otherwise, frankly, I probably would not have bothered to make the effort. Recovery, however you define it, is not something you do alone. My recovery was completely influenced by everyone around me. I desperately needed people to treat me as though I would recover completely. I needed people to believe in the plasticity of my brain and thus to have faith in my continued ability to learn, heal, and grow. I needed those around me to be encouraging, to know that I still had value. I needed to have dreams to work toward. I needed to redefine my priorities for what I wanted to focus upon intentionally and not waste my energy on any other things. I needed people to love me not for the person I had been, but for who I might now become. And the blessing I received from this experience was the knowledge that deep internal peace is accessible at any time. And Dr. Taylor goes on to list 40 things I needed the most. This is in an appendix. And I'm going to read just a few items from her lengthy list because these particular ones I have also needed the most. One, make eye contact with me. I'm here. Come find me. Encourage me. Two, stimulate my mind when I have the energy to learn something new, but know that sometimes even a small amount may wear me out. Three, introduce me to the world kinesthetically by seeing, feeling, touching, tasting. Let me feel things. I am like an infant again. Sparkly-eyed, wow, for the first time. Ask me multiple choice questions, not yes-no questions. Ask me multiple choice questions with specific answers and allow me time to rummage around and hunt for answers. Handle me gently just as you would a newborn. Speak to me directly and not about me to others. Cheer me on. Expect me to recover completely, even if it takes 20 years. Be protective of me, but do not stand in the way of my progress. Celebrate all of my little successes, for they encourage me. Love me and care for me for who I am today. I am not the person I was before. That's by Dr. Jill Taylor. At about 7 a.m. on another December morning, it was 7 weeks ago, I was exploring the San Andreas Fault along the earthquake trail at Point Reyes, California. Suddenly, the world as I knew it collapsed when a mild stroke hit on the right side of my lower brain. And over the next couple of hours, my mind deteriorated in its ability to process information and to connect with the left side of my body. Over the following weeks of treatment and rehabilitation, I also discovered that the stroke itself was not central to what my life was really about. To be sure, the stroke was a traumatic event, yet it was also a turning point through which profound insights have come to me about stuff that really matters. Some of you may remember my remarks back in August, making a subtle distinction between stuff that's true and stuff that matters. To be sure, they overlap. Most of my former career was about stuff that's true. Most of ministry is about stuff that matters. And today is also about STM, stuff that matters. And in the weeks since that December morning, I have dwelled in several, let's call them holding environments, including sanctuaries of protection and comfort, and also crucibles of transformation and something new taking root. The encouragement of my family and of you here at People's Church and of my friends and my UUMA colleagues, all this encouragement has been a true blessing. Today I want to speak briefly for, just 12 to 14 minutes, and I am going to stop at 11:40 to make time for really the central event of the service, which will be a conversation involving not just me, but several others in the congregation who have experienced the kind of jolt that I have. So I'm going to end at 11:40 or thereabouts, and I want to address two questions which, in a way, serve as a bridge between my former career of stuff that's true and my 28 years of ministry focusing on stuff that matters. First of all, I'm going to consider the question, how have tipping points, I won't say catastrophes because that has negative connotations. I'm going to use the words tipping points, the sense of Malcolm Gladwell. How have tipping points or threshold events served as the pacemakers or the punctuation marks in living systems of all sorts? And secondly, I want to be a bit more specific about how did my tipping point event of about 51 days ago reorient my perspectives on stuff that really matters? First, a little background. Just a brief background. Up until very recently, the dominant worldview among, let's just say, progressive, enlightened folks was something like this. The earth is very old, 4 to 5 billion years old. And changes in living and non-living systems on the earth happens slowly and gradually because we have billions of years to work with. And present-day processes can fully explain everything that has ever happened. You don't need special creation or miracles or catastrophes. You don't need to have something magic quickly happen to explain what's going on because we've got billions of years to work with. That was the dominant worldview up until about 35 years ago. And right around then, 1977, I believe it was, my mentor and his colleague, Niles Eldridge, came up with a new model, which has been abbreviated PUNC-EEK, which stands for punctuated equilibrium. And it simply says that the way things happen is not by gradual change, but if you look at both living and non-living systems, it's a staircase, not a gradual slope. Namely, there are long periods of time of relative stability, and then, usually without warning, there's a hiccup or something comes along to abruptly realign conditions, and you move to another place of relative stability that may churn its way along for years or millions of years, and then another event comes along. This was the model that Gould and Eldridge introduced in 1977, and it was met with outrage. What do you mean, these staircase events? Everybody knows that change happens slowly and gradually. And so the very notion of catastrophes sounded way too much like the book of Genesis again. Way too much like special pleading. In fact, Gould and Eldridge's model was called by some evolution by jerks. Let me give you just one example of a tipping point event. There are hundreds, thousands. One example, some of you may be familiar with the book of Genesis and the legend of Noah's flood. A legend which, by the way, is common in the literature of many different languages and cultures of the ancient Near East around present-day Turkey and Syria and Lebanon and Israel, Palestine, and so forth. Such legends in many different languages, legends of a sudden flood, are very common. Well, what's going on? A couple of my colleagues, Bill Ryan and Walter Pittman at Lamont in New York, discovered probably what was the tipping point event, namely the rising of sea level gradually since the last glaciation at about 7,560 years ago, plus or minus a weekend. That rising of sea level finally topped over the Bosphorus, connecting the Aegean to the Black Sea, and a massive influx of water suddenly filled up not only the Black Sea, but literally hundreds of civilizations that surrounded the Black Sea and the tributaries of rivers leading into the Black Sea. Now, was this the event that prompted Noah's flood and the other legends? Who knows? But it's at about the right time. Who knows? There was a lot of stuff going on as sea level rose since 18,000 years ago. And certainly the timing of that Bosporus waterfall, if you will, and it's been dated very precisely using carbon-14 in the drowned civilizations. There are many drowned civilizations that have been looked at by submersible and other little toys. That's one tipping point event, namely Noah's flood. But goodness, there are thousands of such sudden events. And this has been one of the signatures of my previous career, is that changes in both living and non-living systems have been marked by threshold events when conditions suddenly exceed some limit and all of a sudden all the rules have to be rewritten. Of course, the other event which I referred to and which is why we're here on North 10th Street was Chicxulub, the crater which you can see very clearly in the present Yucatan Peninsula. If you fly over it with a gravity meter or magnetometer, there is this circular crater about, I think it's 120 kilometers across, something like that. And that's why you and I are here today. It's causing an impact. Let me shift now to, let's call it, how my mind is changing. What's different for me based on an impact 51 days ago, 51 days and a couple of hours? First of all, during this time, I have been dwelling on balcony space. That's a phrase I've used before, and it simply means that now, in addition to being in a field of action, I'm on a balcony observing myself and observing others with whom I'm interacting. I'm putting on a wider angle set of lenses. I'm listening and observing for offstage characters who may not be at the center of action, but I'm trying to anticipate and pay attention to that which I, in the midst of being only in action space, may have been overlooking. So for most of the last 51 days, I have been in balcony space in the sense of seeing not only my present and past life with a larger window, but anticipating options for the future. So that's point number one, dwelling on balcony space. Point number two, I have appreciated, believe me, I have appreciated how I am readily replaceable. Nothing reminded me of that more poignantly than when Chris Schluter, our fine administrator, sent me the January newsletter and I saw, Viola, I have been totally replaced in January, including for today's service. My colleague up in Grand Rapids was fully ready to come down here today and cover for me if need be. And my goodness, I think my name was somewhere in the January newsletter, but it was... But this was a wonderful reminder to me of the agility and resilience of People's Church and that I am very replaceable and nothing could be better news. This was stunning and it was reassuring. It was very reassuring. A third insight. By virtue of being on the balcony, I'm giving myself permission to pay real close attention to very small details, to seemingly minor and trivial events. A couple of examples. If one of the volunteers or paid staff in the rehab ward where I'm living makes a gesture to express kindness or appreciation or to bring something to me, I notice this and I thank them for it because it really matters. Small stuff really matters. It matters so much, in fact, that really since day one, I vocalize out loud to myself and to anybody else who happens to be around, I vocalize to myself what I happen to be doing. For instance, when I was first on my feet and walking, one of the rules is to always approach a new surface or a curve at right angles. And so I would say out loud, okay, now I am slowing down to make a right angle turn, and I am remembering to put my left foot down first when I go down and my right foot down first when I climb And all of these were not only information reminders. These vocalizations were establishing brain-body connections simply by speaking to myself to the degree that I was able to speak, the actions I was taking. It was also going in the direction of reestablishing connections with my right brain and the left side of my body, which had been turned into jello pretty much. So I'm paying closer attention. Small details really matter. A fourth item that has mattered, and this is another lesson from my previous career. Now, on a large scale, evolution is directed by tipping point events. And that Black Sea waterfall example I gave you and Noah's flood, that's just one of thousands of events. And here's what's interesting. After such tipping points, after such catastrophes, what happens? In living systems, they tinker. Evolution tinkers by trial and error, by working with the raw materials that happen to be available. Evolution does not sit back and intelligently design something that will work. That's not how evolution works. It's not an intelligent designer. Evolution is a bumbler, a tinker. It works with the raw materials and the cast of characters and the conditions that happen to be available. And in the same way, the brain, with its neuroplasticity, in trying to reestablish connections, it bumbles. It does not sit back like a rational brain maybe should and say, okay, how's the best way to do this? It bumbles, and I can feel my brain bumbling to find new connections with the left side of my body. It's a bumbling process. It's tinkering. What does this have to do with anything? I know the search committee is listening to me right now. Tinkering is what matters in systems of all sorts, far more than intelligent design. Far more. Let me make one more remark, and then we're going to approach a time for shifting to some conversation. And here I'm going to repeat myself from a Sunday, I believe it was back in November. Some of you may have been here. But this does bear repeating, and I recognize that some of you may have heard this quotation before. It's what my mentor Steve Gould calls the great asymmetry, namely that destruction or a stroke or a trauma can happen in an instant, but it takes 10 gazillion times longer to rebuild and heal. This is the great asymmetry. On 9/11, 19 individuals with box cutters could cause so much global harm, and it is still taking 10 gazillion acts of kindness to rebuild what can be destroyed so quickly. It's not fair. The asymmetry between evil and creative goodness, it's just not fair. It's not right. But that great asymmetry is part of the pacing of life. On 9/11, Steve was on an Alitalia flight from Milan back to JFK and was rerouted to Halifax, as every other flight was on 9/11. He was able to somehow commandeer a rental car, I think the last one, and drive back to his Manhattan home. And when he got there, he and his wife and their son, Ethan, volunteered for several days at Ground Zero, supporting rescue workers and others. And as a result of their volunteer work at Ground Zero, Steve wrote what became, I believe, a front page column in the New York Times. And I want to quote from just a bit of Steve's remarks after 9/11. And then we're going to move to some conversations. Steve writes, "Good and kind people outnumber all others by thousands to one. The tragedy of human history lies in the enormous potential for destruction in very rare acts. Complex systems can only be built slowly, step by step, whereas destruction requires but an instant. Thus, in what I call the great asymmetry, every incident of evil and harm must be balanced by 10,000 acts of kindness, often unnoticed and invisible. The same has been true for me. Stuff that matters most is those 10,000 gazillion acts of kindness and gratitude in acknowledging and blessing and thanking those who bestow such kindness in this world. The many kindnesses that I have experienced began with my doctor and the medical director at California Pacific, Dr. Scott Rome. And they focused on a poem which I put in the February newsletter and which I'd like to close with our reading together aloud now. This is called Mind to Heart. Please join me in reading this aloud. Yesterday the clay cracked but did not break. They made promises over cookies and tea and some mind and scales to break the spell. Your make-believe dreams fell as tears. While they made promises over cookies and tea. Yesterday, we were lost in fallow fields where make-believe dreams fell as tears and songs echoed in the empty well. Yesterday, while we were lost in fallow fields, lost memories sowed in seeds from an empty well, sages cried, clouds were promises of rain. Today, lost memories of so more seeds, we banish mind and heart and meaning a spell. Sage the same from the empty well, and those seeds grow with the rain on my spell. I'd like to now invite my friends Chris Schluter, Jan Park, Bob Zwicker, and Donna to please join me in the chairs up front. I'm going to ask my four friends and colleagues to, if they wish, make some of their own remarks, and then we will open it to questions and comments from the congregation. So please come join me up front. Are we on here? Yeah. Okay, let's use this mic. Why don't we do this? I'm going to start with Chris, and if you would like to speak spontaneously or have prepared any remarks, that's fine. I think the central thing that we're focusing on is how has the particular tipping point event in your life directed you towards stuff that matters? To be sure, we could talk about the biology of our particular traumatic events, and that may be interesting. But what I think really matters, the stuff that matters, is this question. How did your experience of a tipping point refocus you on what really matters? Chris?
So I'd like to thank Dave for inviting me to be a part of this. And, you know, I haven't really talked about this publicly. I think some of, what was said in the reading today about, not wanting people to look you in the eye and not, you don't want to be somebody who people feel sorry for. Like, nobody wants to be that. And I think that's some of the reason that I haven't talked about this. So why I'm up here, 17 months ago, I was in a car accident where I experienced whiplash and a concussion. And with a wink to David Isaacson's sense of humor, for those of you who haven't experienced whiplash, I will say it's a real pain in the neck. So as a result of the whiplash, what happened was I developed muscle spasms in my body. Mostly they start in my back. As they increase, it works its way up my neck. And then it eventually reaches my head, where then it makes it difficult to think clearly and sometimes think at all, which was why I missed quite a bit of time last year working. So the experience for me was especially difficult. You know, I'm somebody who identifies, or my identity is one where I use my brain, and I'm, you know, proud of, you know, trying to work, problem solve, and work my way through things, and identifying as somebody who sees himself as a reasonably smart person. Suddenly, not being able to think is an incredibly difficult place to be in. And so here, you know, I'm in this new space of trying to find you know, a new identity or find self-worth in a new spot, because I'm not able to do the things that I used to be able to do. You know, because of this pain, you know, the first thing I was trying to do was ignore it, and you can't do that with what I was going through, because it was too high, the intolerable, kind of unmanageable pain. So ignoring it doesn't work. You know, we're fighters in this country. You know, we try to fight diseases, we try to fight injustice, we try to fight for equality. And so, you know, my peaceful pacifist nature, you know, I'm a fighter underneath all that, you know. So I was trying to fight my way through this pain, you know, and it seemed like the more I would fight it, the worse it got, you know. So I'd try to be doing my, you know, mind over matter stuff, be mentally tough, be really strong. So, you know, you're not gonna beat me, pain. I'm gonna will myself over this. And you know, as much as I was fighting to do that, you know, it didn't work. You know, the pain was too much. So, you know, I had days where I was just absolutely, completely defeated. Just, you know, it was too much. And then you feel sorry for yourself, and but then, you know, you have days where you start feeling a little better, and then you move past that. What do I say? So the lesson, you know, I guess, for me through all of this experience, you know, we all as people eventually get to a point where we have, you know, aches and pains, you know, where we have less energy to do things and accomplish things, and we see our abilities start to fade. You know, things that we used to be able to do, you know, we if we live long enough, we reach a point where we can't do those things. And so when you're in that place, you know, where do you find your self-worth? And so for me, it's your attitude. You know, if you can, you know, approach these things in such a way that, you know, all this stuff is happening, but you're you're not getting all your self-worth out of just the things that you can think and what your brain can do, but, you know, how you approach your life. You know, that's been a reiteration for me on something that I've always thought, that you can't always control your circumstances, but you can control what you do, how you approach those circumstances. So, yeah.
Twenty years ago, my life changed drastically. I had a stroke one morning, evening, on a mountaintop in Nepal. I've always believed in the goodness of others, and so I was never completely panicked. I returned to the States after 2 weeks in a hospital in Kathmandu, then to Borges, and then home, and 6 months of therapy. I was constantly amazed by the help given to me by my family and friends, and certainly the people of People's Church. I could not have come as far as I have without their support. It has been an experience of a lifetime, and I'm so happy to be here. I don't know what else to say. One of the really small little things that happened in the hospital, my right side was completely gone. And a woman who'd had a stroke when she was in her 30s, her daughter had brought, her little daughter had brought to her, it was Valentine's Day, a little box with candy in it. And her job was to take out each piece of candy. And she brought me a box of caramel corn. And you had to pick each piece up. And, you know, one day you could pick up one piece, and the next day you could pick up two. And just little things like that, and all the rides I had for 6 months to therapy. So here I am.
Well, I'm not quite as upbeat about this as Dave is. I had the stroke a year ago, February, which is almost 2 years now. One of the things that it prompted me to do was to move. The first, when I got home, I knew that I should move from my country home, which was quite a few miles of travel for me. I knew I should be getting out of my own home, which was getting to be quite a responsibility. And yet I had not done that. This prompted me to get busy and sell my house and move, which I did, with the help of a lot of family and a lot of friends from People's Church here. It was wonderful. Now I live in a carefree apartment in Parkview Hills. I have no real responsibilities for keeping the water running and the heat on. And I am among friends at Parkview Hills also, which is pretty nice. And I survived all this. It was a traumatic experience to move from a house that I'd been there for quite a few years. When I was discharged from the hospital, they gave me 18 months to be carefree, rest when you wanted to, when you were willing and able. Don't do anything, you know, really difficult. Well, I had moved, which but aside from that, I was doing whatever I wanted to. Now my 18 months is up, and I'm still lazy and doing what I feel like, even though I have other responsibilities. That license is expired, but I keep on going. But I was never, my body from here down was never affected by my stroke. It was from here up, and I'm not really sure about some of the things in the brain that are happening, but we continue.
I also had my stroke February of almost 2 years ago. For a while I was on a feeding tube, and I found that going out to dinner with friends is a social event rather than a nourishment event. I would inject my dinner before I went, and I'd go out and we'd sit there and I'll have a steak, I'll have shrimp, I'll have this, I'll have a glass of ice, please. And I lived like that for about a month and a half, and then they took the feeding tube out. I don't know if anybody's ever had a feeding tube. Dave says that it's he couldn't get barbecue sauce through it. But it's basically the size of a pencil with a little plastic end that's about the size of a dime. And when they pull that thing out of you, they pull that dime through that pencil-sized hole, and it's like being hit with a rock. I did have to learn to walk again. I'm not 100%. My left side is still doesn't feel hot or cold and doesn't feel sharp. So I can pick things up, but I can also stick a pin in my hand or put my hand in cold water or hot water, and it feels the same. It stings. I don't know if it stings because it's hot or stinging because it's cold. So I have to be careful when I get a shower, when I load the wood-burning stove. But I tell people, I'm 90% of where I was. If I get that other 10% back, great. If I don't get that 10% back, great.
Thank you so much, friends. I'm noting the time, and so here's what I'd like to do. I do want to... We're doing important stuff here today, so I'm going to let us run a few minutes over. Those of you who have kids in RE, you know that they do like to dismiss the kids at noon to five after. So please do what you need to do to pick up kids if that's relevant for you. But what I'd like to do is open it up to questions that some of you may have for my friends who have kindly joined me up here. And so, yeah, Eric, if you could be our microphone wrangler and just raise your hand if you have a question for any of my friends up here. And let's let it go for 5 or 10 minutes. Then we'll have the offering and the closing song. And please do take care of your kids if you need to pick them up. So raise your hand if you have a question for my friends here.
I've been reading the new Ticket magazine for 2015, winter 2015, and I was reading about some of the things that were going on in the world that are good. And I'm wondering, and this is just a broad question, which may not actually be germane, but it arose, are there no good tipping points?
Okay, Catherine asked if there are any good tipping points. And some of you may remember, I think it was a Buddhist parable where someone says, oh, I lost my goat. And then, well, is that good? Is that bad? And then it goes on to the next thing. Well, there are consequences. Is it good? Is it bad? I think this is what I have learned about tipping points, is that any kind of judgmentalism about good and bad, be very careful before you evaluate any tipping point. It's probably not a either-or situation. That's one of my learnings. I never thought there would be so many doorways which would unfold for me out of this supposed trauma. So, yes, there are positive tipping points, and I've tried to name at least a few of the positive aspects of this trauma. The tip of the feeding tube thing is very real. I could not get Hogzilla barbecue down that feeding tube, no matter how I tried.
Hi, I'm Jen. I work as a hospice nurse. I don't use this term often or lightly. It's one of the greatest blessings that you could possibly imagine to be with families when they are in these very critical tipping points. They feel very, very acute, very, very dramatic. And to hold hands with folks as they realize that it's a bad tipping point, shifting to a peaceful experience is a really amazing journey to witness over and over and over and over again. And so, yeah, related to good and bad tipping points, it's interesting to know when it's both at the same time.
I'm struck by all of your stories. Obviously, you express a lot of emotion in this, but I'm also struck by the tremendous courage. One emotion I don't hear whatsoever is that of fear. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I don't know. I always just felt that someone was going to take care of me, and they did. They did. The friends that, a couple friends that I had made in Kathmandu, brought me chocolate chip cookies because we had brought him chocolate chips from the States when we came over, and it just I don't know. It was just that the goodness of people. I just the only time I broke down in Kathmandu was when I talked to my daughter. That was hard. But woke up 2 days into the whole thing, and there were these two young men by my bed. And they explained that they were the son and his friend who were he was the child of a neighbor of a friend of mine. And my friend had said, oh, did you guess what happened to Donna? And the woman said, oh, my son's in Kathmandu. So they called and they came to see me. And at that point, even early on, the insurance companies were arguing about who was going to deal with this. And one of their suggestions was that my son come over and get me. And I thought, well, that's really dumb. I looked up and there they were. And I said, well, you call your mother and have your mother call my friend. My friend will call my son and tell him, don't do that. And they finally, 2 weeks later, hit upon a plan. But anyway, it was just that you always knew that there was somebody there, even though it was very slight. Yeah.
I was afraid I wouldn't be able to write again. You know, I'm a writer. And that was my big fear, is that, you know, this thing that I love doing, you know, I wouldn't be able to do that.
I'm a hospice social worker. I've been fortunate to have the conversation with Bob about things like feeding tubes. What would you do if this happens again, if it happens to a loved one? How much treatment would you pursue?
Well, as I say, the feeding tube was an annoyance until they took it out. Then it hurt. But I think you all remember, I think I have the record for the shortest joys and concerns. Two words, three syllables, nine letters. Solid food. But I think that, you know, if you're in severe pain, yes, stop. But I was never really in severe pain. I couldn't walk. I could talk most of the time with a little bit of slurring. But other than that, I was fine. When I was growing up, my father had polio when he was 6 years old, and had walked on canes for his entire life. So I realized that, you know, if I can't walk again, that's not the end of the world. And I don't really know what would be the thing that would say, okay, stop, you know. But if you know, this did not approach that at all, to be honest with you.
Let's have one or two more, and then I think we'll wrap it up. Jean?
Mine isn't a question, it's a statement. I'm an occupational therapist, and I think you five people should go out on the road. Because you're going to give people hope that don't have it. I mean, they don't have a support group like you five do. You are very lucky. And we, not everybody is. And I wanted to say how great all five of you are.
I just wanted to say I agree with the support group. It's been really, really important, terribly important, to have the church, my friends, and all of that. My fear to go back a little bit, is that my head, my mind might give way. I have a little trouble speaking, and I have a little trouble eating. But thinking, you know, I'm really not quite sure that I'm doing that very well either. And so that does concern me.
When I was finishing with my physical therapist and seeing my neurologist, the PA, I asked her, can I use a chainsaw? And she said, yes, as long as I was careful.
Well, on that note, the morning offering for the work of People's Church will now be received.